Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
And the crowd went narcoleptic. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. Little sideline, I went to a meeting yesterday, and outside of the meeting perimeters, there was a new fella in there, a young man, and we started talking, and I asked him how much time did he have in sobriety. He said he had gotten 90 days. He had accumulated 90 days. So that's wonderful. I said, you're going to get your 90-day chip. He said, no, I can't. I drank yesterday, and now I only have 89 days. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, that's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Sweet Home, Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. They do this, and the price is really good. It's free. They do for us because they believe in what we're doing. We believe in what we're doing, and we hope that you believe in what we're doing. We're carrying the message of recovery. We'd like also to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine, we'll find a recovery journal, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I'd greatly like to introduce my co-host, Harold B. Harold's a family intervention specialist and does a fine work with troubled families. I personally believe that families are the basic unit of our society, and as the family goes, so does the country, so does the nation, basically so does the world. Harold also goes to the prisons, and both with the families, we find that the children have not been taught correct principles. Latchkey kids, the common phenomenon still is today. And also we have children growing up like empty lot weeds. There's nobody home. They're not being taught correct principles. Parents are expecting the schools to do it. The schools really aren't prepared to teach them morality. They're just there to teach them the ABC. Is that you, Harold? You're moving around there?
No, I'm not moving, but we'll figure it out.
Okay.
Hello, everybody. It's nice to be on the air again. I appreciate Joseph for creating the website at his own expense, creating the radio program at his own expense, and that's for him, that's his way of giving back. For me, this is my way of giving back, and I really, really appreciate the opportunity to give back. People were there at the meetings when I got there, and because they were so loving and warm and welcoming, it saved my life. I worked the 12 steps with a very mean sponsor, somebody I didn't like that much, but I think it's better that way, that I didn't really like him. He didn't like me either, but we got through the steps. I learned the principles and applied those in our daily lives. We went out and did a lot of 12-step calls, something I don't really hear much about these days, but it was really an important part of my recovery and early on. We went out. At one point, I took a fellow to rehab three times. He would walk in the front door, right out the back door. and then get drunk again. And then he did put together some days of recovery, but at one point he got rear-ended in his car, a car wreck, and the doctor gave him some pain pills, and he's dead now. I helped do the funeral. So it's really been important for me to have the warm welcomes and all the hugs in the meetings, to work the steps with a tough sponsor. And the reason I can do that is because people followed the principles and worked the steps before me, and they were there to welcome me with love and warmth, and that's why I'm alive. So I want to encourage all of you, learn the 12 steps, and then begin to teach the 12 steps, because that's when you really get the program and get the spirit of it. That's how it started. That's how it's continued for 70 years, and I'm honored to be part of it. That's the way I met God. My first sponsor told me that drinking is a search for God at the wrong address. And that really meant a lot to me, and I figured out what he was talking about gradually. Mine is the educational variety of enlightenment, the gradual type. And so started off as an agnostic, and now I really feel like I know God quite well. I read his living word on a daily basis, and that's like working the steps too. We've got to get in there with pen and paper and really study. So, let me mention, we have a call-in number, 949-534-0621, 949-534-0621. So please, if you'd like to be part of the program or ask a question or make a comment, use that number and call in. Let's see. I think that's it. Let me turn it back over to you, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. It's interesting. We use the word 12-step call. Now, most folks not in the program have not a clue what that means. Someone has called in, usually through what we call an exchange called an intergroup, and the phone has come to a local area, a local group, and usually two men, sometimes three, but no less than two is advised, go out to some guy that's in the throes of his addiction and has a moment of clarity and asks for help. So we get up on our horse and we go that free of charge. We go find him, dig him out of the hole he's in. Some of those visits are really quite stressful, but we do that because it was done for us in some cases, and this way we have the ability to stay sober. What's happened is the rehabs have gone to great lengths in marketing, and a lot of the 12-step calls, especially in Houston, are available because folks are going to the rehabs, and that's okay. I think we're missing the boat by not partnering up with the rehab, since they've gone through the time and expense of gathering the sheep. They're already there. Let's go get them while we're in the corral. We don't have to go get them, pick them out one at a time. They're already there. But I think we're going to come to that agreement down the road. But that's a 12-step call. We're going out to someone who's in the throes of the disease, has a moment of clarity, and calls in for help. And this is the help that we send them. The good news is that we have the solution to alcohol and drug addiction. We do. It's a proven fact. It's a spiritual, a physical, and mental disorder. And we have that. It works if you work the program. The bad news is we are the solution. You know, like we have people from Penn State and the state pen. We have people that are recently released from the asylums. We have doctors. We have all the professions. We even allow lawyers in. That'll give you an idea how open the recovery is. We let everybody in. Everybody's welcome. We're exclusively all-inclusive. If there's a very limited requirement Groucho Marx says, I will not join any club that will have me as a member. Actually, we even let him in, too. The only requirement is a desire, or if you say so. If you say you're a member, you're a member. Though it's the door is wide open. We keep the door wide open, and in some clubs, we keep the light on 24 hours. So there is hope, there is recovery, there is light at the end of the tunnel, but there's one thing that you got to do. You got to take an action. If you look in the scriptures, it says, you turn towards God, and then God turned towards you. It's one turn deserves another. You got to take that first step. You got to take that first action, and then you can find the relief that you're looking for. But if you don't take the action, if you don't believe, we only ask you for a mustard seed of willingness. It works. It really works. When you're in your disease, you're so spiritually divorced, bankrupt, that it seems like all hope is gone. It doesn't have to be that way. Not at all. Take that little step. God will do the rest, but you're going to have to take that little mustard seed and take that action. Okay, well, disclaimer, this is not AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. This is not NA, Narcotics Anonymous. Not CA, Cocaine Anonymous. This is Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. And if you've been sleeping through your recovery, you consider it Narcoleptics Anonymous, and this is a wake-up call. Get into action. This is what we're selling you, folks. We're selling you get into action. That's where recovery really is in action. We're saved by grace after all that we can do, not after all that we can talk, not after all that we can think, not even after all that we can pray. The magic words in AA is action and more action, for faith without works is dead. Now, this part of the show, we have a special guest tonight, and I very rarely say special, unless it's Sunday night. John Cates. are you there, John?
Yeah. I think I'm glad I am.
Not sure. Wait a minute. You haven't finished up yet. Just hold on. I've got a little bit more. I'm going to read how it works, and then I'm going to turn you over. The way we work the interviews is that we have people of note. We've had some people that are pillars in the recovery community. John is one of those pillars. And because they usually have people of note have better jokes, so we get them on. But we also do the regular Joe, just a regular guy out there that has no particular claim. He's just working a solid program. And you know why we do that? Because you can't put a yardstick on a miracle. What I've come to the conclusion is AA and NA and CA, they're a group of dead people complaining that they're alive. So we give them a platform to complain that they're still alive. I like to read how it works. This is found in the basic text of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The Big Book contains the original 12 steps. There was no 12 steps before Bill Wilson, the co-founder of AA, wrote them. It's an interesting article about that. He sat down for a half an hour, and he finally put it all together, and he mentions he didn't feel inspired at the time. Isn't that strange? I'm inspired when I read them. But he said when he wasn't inspired when he wrote them. So sometimes you never know for sure how God's got his hand in there, but there was definitely God had his hand in there. I tell my church this. They have their own 12 steps. I've been trying to get AA under their roof. They're not buying it because they want Jesus and Heavenly Father. That's their understanding. And I said, well, look, guys, I says, if the 12 steps are not a gift from God, why have you adopted them? And if they are a gift from God, why do you feel compelled to change them? Of course, not only don't they don't answer me, they don't like to talk to me if they can avoid it. But look, we do what we can when we can. So this is chapter 5, how it works. And it really does work, but this is how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. that those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They're such unfortunates. They're not at fault, so they seem to have been born that way. They're naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you decided you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go, absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there's one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measured availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took were suggested as a program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaim, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and the personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic, could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would.
And would if he were.
Yes, God couldn't. You know, it's funny. That just seemed to pop up out of nowhere. Everybody was started doing it at the same time. That everyone chimes in a meeting at that last proposition. I think that would be for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. Well, that's enough out of me. Would someone else like to talk about me? No, I guess not.
I would. No.
Well, I'm Fred John. It's what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and what keeps you to maximum service to God and your fellow beings. So we're interested to see how to fellow with you with what do you have, like 30 years?
38 years.
38
wow.
years. Holy cow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
It's a grace. It's all grace, as you said earlier. But what I said is I wanted to talk about you some more. No, I'm just kidding. I won't do that.
Okay. No problem. You know, the scientists had discovered that there was a whole different and separate universe. Did you know that? Not galaxies,
oh, yeah.
Separate different years. Yeah. Well, I was so excited when I heard the news. I went out and applied for the position of center. I might
and
have
I believe you think
more.
You got it.
Well, I'm online. There's a few folks in front of me, yeah, but I think we'd really like to hear from your story. When was the first time you drank or did a drug and it rang the bell?
It always is an honor and a pleasure to have a chance to tell it. And I got to tell you, it's an honor and a pleasure to be on this show with you guys. And I feel really outclassed because the wit, the humor, the insight to the disease that you guys have is just incredible. And this is a great show. I've really enjoyed just being a part, even the short time I have. But to kind of say who I am and where I came from, I was just a little goober kid born in 1951, hanging out with great parents in a great home, introduced to a loving, giving, caring, great, grace-filled God on a regular basis. I was the Beaver. If anybody out there is old enough to know who Leave It to Beaver was, well, I was the Beaver. And it's a different one. Well, we won't get into the Beaver thing. Anyway, So I was hanging out, doing all that stuff. These were in the days, you guys may be old enough to know that at one time in the United States, in this culture, you mentioned the culture and the family and the relationship between the two. Well, one time in the old days in this culture, if you did something wrong, your parents could possibly kill you and it'd be considered, responsible parenting. CPS stood for Child Punishment Services at that time, and that it was very different in those days. There were, there were no fences in the yards. Groups of kids left the house at dawn and or right after breakfast with their dogs, and a group of kids ran one way, and a group of dogs ran with them, and then you came back, for dinner, and you did what your parents said because it was a very serious business if you didn't. So I did.
If they didn't know much about the Bible, the one thing they did remember, the one phrase they remembered, it was spare the rod and spoil the child. They could quote that verbatim at any given time.
And honor your mother and father.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They had that one down. Well, mine really were compassionate, comparatively, very compassionate. But I did, the whole culture just responded the children did pretty much what you were told most of the time, unless you had parents who weren't looking. And there weren't any parents like that at that time, not in my life anyway. My parents were definitely looking. So I did what I was supposed to. I made good grades. I believed in God. I did what I was supposed to. It was in Amarillo, Texas, going to high school. And girls had come into my life. They terrified me. I had no idea what to do with them. And I decided that I needed to go to any lengths possible to be able to talk to them. Became a member of what we called the Hellraisers. In those days, there was no marijuana in Amarillo yet, but there were Hellraisers, and they drank, and I tried drinking, and it was magic. For me, just magic. Suddenly I could talk to girls. The only problem was I also threw up on them. And my parents, my mother had the best nose this side of the Mississippi. She could smell alcohol before I turned the corner at the end of the street. And drinking was not okay. Not okay. My parents drank very, very little, if at all, at times.
Were they Baptist? Was it a religious thing, or they just didn't like alcohol?
Well, they were Baptists, but that's not why they didn't drink. They just didn't think it was a good idea. It was explained to me. This will make you drink, you do things you wish you hadn't. It always leads, nothing good ever. That's the phrase they would use. Nothing good ever comes out of drinking, so we just don't do it hardly at all. Every once in a great while, they would have a little something, but I mean, it was rare. And I thought they were right, but I sure wanted those girls to talk to me, and that was one of the requirements, is that you drink a little beer. With my mother and with the fact that it made me sick, I just couldn't do it very much at all during high school. But I left when I graduated early from high school, 17 years old the day I graduated from high school. I wasn't smart. I just got ahead, and my dad was in the Air Force, and I just stayed ahead. He was getting ready to leave the summer before my senior year. I didn't want to go to a brand-new high school my senior year. I had a girlfriend. She was going to the University of Houston. She was a year older than me. So I just graduated a year early and came to the U of H at 17 years old in 1968. And, boy, you could count the number of people with long hair on that campus on one hand when I got there. By the summer, they were everywhere, and marijuana had hit big time in that particular group there. And I smoked my first dope, and it was, again, just magic. It didn't make me sick. It was hard to tell people, for people to tell I was loaded. I fell in love. From the time I was 17 until I was 25, I smoked dope every day and anything else I could find. I also drank some, but I did something every day. The last 3 years, I was shooting heroin, and that was being done regular. I'd have a habit. I was one of those guys, though, that while I was doing all of that, in order to prove how I truly was in control, I stayed in school. By golly, I was terrified to flunk out or do bad in school because it would prove that I was out of control behind using, and I loved getting high. I loved it. So it motivated me to stay on top of my studies and things, and I stayed in school. I graduated from the University of Houston with a degree in education. I had worked part-time in addition to getting high. While I went through it, I got a job with HISD at a time when there were three teachers for every position. I went to work here at HISD. I was teaching school, taught school for the last 5 years, right at 4 years. I take that back. And kept on using all during that time. I was married my high school sweetheart, by the way, who I'd come to go to school with. She was also somebody who was involved with substances. But I was the epitome of what everybody who got high out there wanted to be. I was the guy who they go, oh, man, he's amazing. He can, he can really do his dope and his dope not do him, Look at him. He's teaching school. He's shooting heroin, when he wants. He can drop it by just doing Quaaludes and smoking dope and drinking. Hey, look how in control he is. And that was
my
going
hero.
On until, I was the poster boy. And I was proud of how, in control I was until this day in October of 1975 when I got arrested for sales and possession of 10 ounces of heroin. It was a record amount of heroin, given the composition at that time of the dope. It was a record amount of heroin for Harris County, 1975, Texas. School teacher. Suddenly I was famous, but not with just the dope fiends. I was on the news. It was horrific, horrific. I was 6'1". By this time, I was right around 140 pounds. Looked like I just walked out of Dachau. When they took me to Harris County Jail, and this was the old Harris County Jail, not the nice one that there's now, the old one. The guys who were there who had been in Cook County and Chicago said that it was worse than Cook County. I believe it was. There were 38 beds while I was there. There were 146 inmates. And I was little old bitty, suburban, skinny white guy, and I was terrified. Couldn't believe that I'd come to this low place. There's a lot of story in all of that. I won't take it through all, but I went through those things you hear about all the time. I finally got out they have an $80,000 bond on me. My roommate.
Money back then.
My partner, it was a lot of money. My partner, well, there were guys who had killed people who were there with smaller bonds than I had. But the partner I got busted with had gathered together some money and had gotten himself out and got me out. And I was terrified to tell my parents. It was like, it just destroyed them. It just destroyed them when I finally had to tell them. But when I got out, you would think that I would have gone, gosh, I need to not use. Of course, I didn't. I thought, you know, oh, I just went too far. Like everybody thinks, I just went too far. I just need to get back in control. Now, while I was there and terrified, there were times I swore I wouldn't. You mentioned a little while ago windows of clarity, you know, and windows of sanity, we call them a lot of times when we're working with it. I had windows of sanity. It would open and then it would close, you know. And by the time I got out of jail, one of the very first things I did was go get high. But I did think I needed to stop doing heroin. Plus, I was so hot, nobody would hardly come around me. So I thought, okay, I need to deal with this court case, because by the time I got to an attorney, the attorney told me that it was very serious and I needed to do three things. He said I needed to, number one, I needed to get a job. Number two, I needed to go back to church. And number three, I needed to get involved with this drug abuse program for young adults and adolescents. It was very special in Houston, Texas at the time, and it was called Palmer Drug Abuse Program. He called it PDAP. And so I thought, okay, I'll do this. I went back to South Main Baptist Church, bless their heart. They were so kind to me, and I think they truly did God's will. Even as insane as I was, you know, God always writes straight, as we've said in the past, with crooked lines. And there was crooked lines going all through my life at the time. But I decided, well, I'm going to tell them whatever they want to hear. I still believed in God. I just wasn't sure how I wanted to play it out, and I needed them to go to court for me. So I sing a little bit, and I do a little drama at times, and especially back then. I joined the choir. It took me about 2 weeks to figure out which young people in the choir were also partying after choir practice. Of course, the ones who were serious about carrying through with what they felt like was God's instructions about mind-changing chemicals and didn't use, they didn't know about the ones who did use. So I, of course, found the ones who did use. They were all young. There were some of them professionals. I ended up living, basically, with one of the young women who was in the choir, but she smoked dope. So that was my go back to church and get well and get ready to go to court. Then I got the people at True Mix Concrete Company, bless their hearts, they gave me a job knowing what I was facing. And I went from, you know, went out on the concrete yard at 135 pounds with all those big concrete drivers and the yard workers. But they gave me a job. Took me about half a day to figure out where they were smoking dope out in the gravel pit next to the reclaimer. So that was getting a job. That was getting straight with the job. The final thing was this PDAP thing. And in those days, in Houston, there's thousands and thousands of people in young people's AA. In 1975 and 76, that wasn't the case.
Right.
And young suburban dope fiends, we really didn't have a place where there were a lot of us to welcome the new ones. But there was this thing called PDAP here that had sprung out of the idea of stick with winners coming from the AA experience and knowledge. And it had started to use steps and try and create a place for young people. It was running off the idea of how important peers are to young people, like they're not to adults. But but it seemed to make sense at the time. The guys who were running it, the oldest guy there was 34 years old. And I decided, okay, I'm going to go in there and con these guys and go in court for me. By this time, things had gotten worse. My co-defendant in the case, one, I'd been on TV. I mean, it was a school teacher, record amount of heroin. I'd been on television. It was horrible. And the co-defendant, he decided he was going to keep on dealing, make a bunch of money, and hire an attorney to get him out of the court case. So
yeah, and you've got to deal to the attorney.
Huh? Yeah.
You've got
to undercover agents. Beg your pardon?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Undercover agents came to arrest him. He thought they were other junkies coming to rip him off, ran to his bedroom, slammed the door shut, grabbed a deer rifle out of his closet. He was just another suburb kid, guys. We're not talking about, you know, Rambo here, just a 25-year-old kid, 24 at the time, and he grabbed his deer rifle, thinking they were other junkies. He fired three shots through the door, which, of course, had it been other junkies, they would have run away. It wasn't. They were three federal agents. He hit three of them, didn't kill them, but he hit them. They shot him 12 times and killed him. So by this time, in the nine-month wait between the arrest and going to trial, I was a school teacher, sales and possession of a record amount of heroin. The co-defendant had shot three federal agents, but had been killed.
Oh, geez.
So I was the only one to be tried. The prosecuting attorney, a fellow named Cobb, who was working under Carol Vance. Carol Vance was the DA at the time. Prosecuting attorney had made it known to my attorney that he was planning on asking 90 years. Now, 90 years was worse than a life sentence. I'm 25 years old at this time, guys. A 90-year sentence was worse than a life sentence because a life sentence, you had came up for parole at 16 years. A 90-year sentence, you didn't have a chance for parole at something like 34 years. I would have just recently gotten out had it gone the way it did. It did not. I went to the PDAP thing, planning on conning them. I walked in. They gave out fists instead of chips for 30 days sober. I said, oh, token reinforcement. Because, see, when I got arrested, I was working on my master's degree in educational administration, going to be, I guess, a dope shooting principal or something, you know.
I
was very active in Houston Teachers Association. I mean, my minor was in psychology. I had master's levels hours in that, all of that going on while I was shooting dope. So I walk into this meeting, and I see them handing out these things, they were their equivalent of chips, and I said, oh, so, you know, token reinforcement. I saw them hug each other. This is social reinforcement. I watched a meeting. I said, transactional, interactional analysis, because they had meeting leaders who would actually interact some. You know, and I sat there, and I never will forget. It's one of the most embarrassing moments of my life is when, up until recently, my first counselor was a fellow named Jim. And we had to bury him last year. But I went in planning on conning him, and I said, listen, man, I've watched all this stuff you're doing. You know, I have a minor in psychology. You know, Mr. Bigwig I'm being. And I see the token reinforcement. I see the transactional interactional analysis, cognitive behavioral movement here. You know, I might can help you. I have this minor thing. I had this minor court case. Maybe you could help me with it. And he just read my mail. He said, sure, we can help you. Sure. He said, all you got to do is you got to come to these meetings so we can know what to say about you. He said, also, these people in this room, you got to make friends with them. You got to become their friends. I said, well, okay. And I'm thinking, oh, great, this is going to be easy con. And so I commenced to con. And in order to con, I had to go to the meeting. And I had to get to know the folks. And I had to be around while they were talking. And it all started sinking in and making sense. For six weeks, I got loaded and lied, broke every rule they had. Had they caught me, they would kick me out. But I kept coming around. And then on March 5th, they had a weekend activity. And I went on it. And I'd been hearing about this 30 days thing. And why don't you stay sober? And I couldn't take any dope with me, because they would have caught me smoking dope. So I thought, I'll just put together these sober days for this long weekend. So I did, and that was my beginning, March 5th, 1976. And I've been sober by the grace of God ever since, because there's been plenty of rough times and bad times and all sorts of stuff, times when I failed to follow through. I went to court, a whole nother story, absolute miracle. I didn't go to prison. I got 10 years probation. I wanted to help with the program, so I started a school. As far as we know, it was the first recovery school. What we've been told by the guys who know, it was the first recovery school ever in the world. It was in 1976, because it was right after I found out I wasn't going to prison, I started the school. And then I gave it to PDAP, and then I went into training as a counselor for them. I opened up a younger group out in Fort Bend County. Then I became the executive director for Houston when it was as large as it ever got. 3,700 young people and parents were in the program at one time. Then I got transferred to Dallas. There was a rock and roll group called Freeway. I got to sing with them. Carol Burnett's daughter came in. I got to work with Carrie. Frank Beard, the drummer of ZZ Top, came in. He got sober. He ended up the best man at my wedding. I got married. I worked in the field all but 4 years, and I volunteered on that during that time. Went back, got a master's degree. And I've been married now to my wife. We just celebrated this weekend, as a matter of fact, 36 years of marriage.
Congratulations.
We have two grown kids. Yeah, it's really cool. It's really awesome. I mean, for a goober lion dog to get graced in that way. I have two beautiful children, a 26-year-old and a 22-year-old. They've both done well. And I have back about 29 years this year, I started up a program. PAP went through some things and had to go, and I ended up producing, directing commercials and industrial films for 4 years and volunteering on the side. Then opened up what is now called Lifeway and Three Oaks Academy. We're here, and we're also in Dallas. That was in 1985. Lifeway is the second oldest alternative peer group type program. It is the program that coined the term alternative peer group. It's the largest one here in Houston.
What does that mean, alternative peer group?
Well,
what is that actually?
Well, if you think back on what we were and how it works, it talks about people who cannot or will not be honest with themselves. If you look
right.
at this disease very closely, all of us have been working constantly trying to get one more sober, trying to help one more get sober, I guess is a better way to say it. The brain damage that comes about because of these substances is profound, a lot more profound than we knew. Now that we have MRIs and PETs, we can see it. We know what's happening. We know how long it takes before that neurotransmitter system that takes the beating, how long it takes before it starts to recover itself. So we end up with this cannot or will not be honest with themselves or follow through. You know, those who take these steps make it. Well, some people don't take those steps. And actually it was AA that first found stick with winners in order to grow, that there was an increase, you know, of if you would make new friends of people who would help you grow, your chances of making it became actually, if you stick with winners, almost 100% is what the research says. If you don't, well, you have a lot of trouble. You change your friends, you make it. You don't. But, I mean, pretty much a lot of times that's the case. Well, that's kind of like talking about the weather. You could know that but not do anything about it. Well, 43
sure.
years ago in PDAP, we started trying to increase and make it easier to find and engage with that new group of friends, that alternative peer group, that group of people who are making it in dealing with the disease you're dealing with, that group of people that might can share it with you and you might listen to. Over those 43 years, however, because it was organized, we have continued to try and figure out how to better use the staff around these groups and how to incorporate the family process, too. It is a case management organization that attempts, like all the rest of the treatment organizations, to increase your chances of being able to insinuate yourself healthily into AA and stabilize and make it. One of the strongest tools is that group of peers that you can get involved with and your family can get involved with who can maximize your chances of being able to follow through with what it takes to stay sober, working the steps, using a sponsor, using AA and not abusing AA, if you know what I mean. And those kind of things. So that's what we're doing now. We got Dallas. Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the steps before we go further. Now, you worked the steps. Did you have a hard time the first time you worked the steps? And did the sponsor, now you mentioned the sponsor, right? Did he find you? Did you find him? How did that pan out?
No. Well, again, because this was in the very beginning days of these alternative peer groups, it was very, very much like just going to AA, only there was a staff there to help you feel your way through it. You know how there are a lot of clubs that will have old-timers that pretty much have become kind of guides and things. Well, these were there weren't old-timers that were 25 years old at that time. But there were people who seemed to have talent, and those people who had talent would get hired to be, quote, counselors in those days. That was this is the Wild West of recovery work. There was no licensed chemical dependency counselor at that time. It was really, really a wild time. But we would look for people who had talent who could share with others how to work the steps, how to find a sponsor, what to look for in a sponsor. So actually, it was not hard for me. It would have been hard, I will tell you, because I was so arrogant and so confused that, and I was not listening. I was not doing what I was told. But there were some people around who I said, like I said, they were just very talented at reading my mail and putting things in a way that it got through to me. And so they took me into the steps and walked me through them, and I did it. It was a real grace thing. I didn't require hospitalization or therapy or anything like that. But I did, I know I required some people who were charged and really felt motivated to reach into my life and discuss and share these things with me.
Let me give me your take on this. Now, we have attraction, not promotion. That's the sound bite. And
right.
What I've discovered is that people have used that sound bite to incorporate sponsorship. You're supposed to be attracted to your sponsor. I was about 5 years in the program, and somebody said, well, if someone comes and offers you to be your sponsor, you didn't walk away from them. You ran away from them. Of course, if you want to hide something from an alcoholic, you put it in the big book.
Right.
So I didn't really read the big book. I was counting. I was planning on getting the program through the process of osmosis. You know osmosis?
Right. Yeah, I know
osmosis. If you sit in enough meetings, yeah. Danny B., he was in my home group. I heard the first time he said that. He's the circuit speaker now. Osmosis, when you sit in enough meetings, and that's the encouragement now, keep coming back, you sit in enough meetings,
right.
The message is going to come to the floor, up the legs of the chair, up your butt and into your head, and an easier, softer way has been found. And that's what I thought was recovery. But now actually reading the big book, actually reading the basic text, it's like, wow, I was abducted by undocumented aliens in some of these groups here. what are they talking? Well, it says three times in the big book, go find the prospect and start working on them. We know that one. Then it also says, if the prospect is not interested in what you have, go find another who is desperate enough to have what you want. And then I think on page 19 it says the man making the approach is the fellow who speaks of having the answer. So three times it's telling us in simple clear-cut instruction that we're supposed to go out and get the
We use the term reach out. Yeah, the term reach out is what we use. And I'll tell you that the question you're asking about did they reach out to me? No. What they did was, though, they taught me some basics about recovery that made a lot of sense to me. One of the things I was told about getting a sponsor, I remember they had a staff member there, and he told me to get a sponsor, and I went through the same thing. I said, well, who does it need to be? And he said, you pick out somebody who has what you want. Now, it was really interesting the way God worked for me. And he said, it doesn't make any difference if you like them or not, or if you just, super get along with them. You pick out somebody that has what you want. You go ask them how they got it. You do what they did, and you see if you don't get it. And that made a lot of sense, and I needed it kept real simple, at the time. So I hate to tell you what it was I wanted, but I want
what
is
his wife? Let me put it to you this way. What did his wife look
go.
Like? That'll
there
give me
go.
A start.
This guy, my first sponsor,
he
had a lot of girls who really liked him. Well, I wanted girls to like me because my first wife, when I got arrested, she actually was there. They told her, go away. You're too good looking to go to jail. So she was gone, at that time. So I was kind of injured because I'd gone through all that crazy free love hippie stuff back in that day.
Right.
And I just was injured around that issue. But there was a guy who, his name was Bill, and he had a lot of girls who liked him. I wanted that. But he also was surviving a court case situation, and I wanted that too. So I asked him. That's what I want. It was a real simple thing. But, man, let me tell you something. He took me aside the first night. And I told you, I play the guitar and sing some. And he played the guitar, and he picked up the guitar, and he played a song called Spider John. And it was that was it. I'd never heard it before for some reason or another, but he just nailed me with it. And he started to share with me the things he was doing with the steps and the readings and all of the meetings and how he was doing it. And I started doing them, and it all started work. All of it started working. I even had a few girls who liked me, which was really weird. But but it wasn't that they jumped toward me and said, please let me sponsor you, but there was some guidance there that was good and solid, coming from a good solid source, saying this is how you, one, you need a sponsor, and two, this is very simply what you look for. And it worked. I did what I was told, and by golly, it worked. I wasn't doing everything I was told, but I did that. Again, it was a grace. Everything about my recovery has been grace. God allowing me to be just sane enough to do just enough to get.
You know what?
I've
been around some time. I got 17 years. So, but what I've seen is that having no other choice, it worked for the people that are still here.
Right.
That's
right.
For the people that didn't,
right.
It didn't work for. We don't hear from them. They're dead.
Well,
so
that
gets
back to what we do.
This
alternative peer group, that's what it's all about. Is, you remember I said one more out of 10 sober? What we do is for that first, because we know that most of us fall out of the program in the first 18 months to 3 years. That's mostly when we fall out. We know that the number of desire chips versus five-year chips, it's much smaller. So we started going, what are some things we could do to help folks stay in and stabilize? One of the big tools we found were families. If they have a family, and if you can teach that family to house, to support through rough times and good times and not sabotage, or, then everybody, those chances of staying in long enough to stabilize get higher. Baylor College of Medicine about 6 years ago a fellow named Scott Basinger there did a study on alternative peer groups with adolescents. Now, we do adults. We do APGs with adults also.
Right.
But he did a study with alternative peer groups with adolescents, and they found that if you use the extra help tools of therapy, hospital, those kind of things, residential program, outpatient groups, those kind of things, to get into recovery for adolescents, then you go up to about 20% making it. If you add on an alternative peer group, this socialization, and it's coordinated correctly, and the continuity of care is there from day one to day 18 months to 3 years, whenever there's certain things about stabilization that present themselves, and that they're working continuity of care, not only depth but width, and dealing with families and maybe employers, those are school, teachers, those kind of things.
Sure.
Then we go from 20% to 80% are making.
Ooh, that's
wow.
Not requires, it's a huge difference. And that's not me saying that. This is what the Baylor study showed. It's being duplicated right now. But the study, because it did survive peer review and all those kind of things. So that's a big thing. It's not, this is nothing in any way to replace the truths of the path that we know is laid out in AA and the
right.
study and understanding of AA. This is just for those who, you know, you go in and out of those windows of sanity. Those the window opens and it closes. And when it closes, you do stupid, crazy things. And they're the things that seem to make us fall out, the ones that you don't hear from, like you said. Well, this process, this alternative peer group, this case management through this alternative peer group, is a technique to try and keep people in and get them past those closed window times. Or if they do fall out, get them back in as quickly as possible before they do more brain damage and create more aberrant psychology, you know, more stinking thinking. And create some continuity of care. So that is exactly where we come from. I loved your comment also. I mean, I got so much out of what you were saying in the very beginning, this culture to family and family to culture. I'm writing a new book, and it's really based around the truth about substance abuse. And it's based on the components of culture. And it's this culture to family and family to culture. It's a circular thing, and somewhere along the way, like you were saying, we got to start telling the truth about all this. These substances break the brain, and it breaks it a lot quicker than a lot of people think, and it breaks it a lot more than a lot of people think. And if we're really, really going to deal with this, we need to start telling the truth. We've tried telling the truth about cigarettes. Let's try telling the truth about alcohol and the other drugs. Notice how I phrased that. Let's sure. quit fooling around and pretending one thing is different than another. These are my opinions, of course, you know.
Sure, yeah.
But,
if you get 15 alcoholics in a room, you're going to get 20 opinions. That's no problem
that's
with
right,
that.
Or
we
more.
Got we even have people who don't even like their George Bush, I had a quote on the website. He said that I have some really strong opinions. Some of them I don't agree with. Sounded like George.
Exactly.
Let me,
I feel.
Now we have another phenomenon. I'm going to get your take on it. I call it singleness of porpoise. See, I personally don't believe it holds water. Bill W., I think under political pressure from the other pristine drunks, decided that NA needed to come, that we needed to distance ourselves again. Now, the third tradition deals with a drug addict, and it worked out really well, and he'd helped thousands. I mean, who did he help and caused no trouble? Well, some a couple years later, after Bill writes the tradition, then all of a sudden we get this little thing about singleness of purpose and that we can only deal with alcohol. Now, the kids are coming in younger, because most of the time because of the powders. So I think we've kind of missed the boat a little bit. Now we have this little backlash going on with the NA. You can't say anything that's referred to AA. And, you know, we have this little enmity between your program is can beat up my program kind of deal. And I think it breaks down the energy required to be successful when fighting a superior foe. We don't have the
amen.
United Front. What?
I said, amen, brother. You're preaching now.
Okay, well, yeah, I always agree with people who agree with me. It's a rule. Well, it's more like a guideline. Now, the 12 steps, there's 2 points. One is in the book. It says, until we've spoken with complete intensive work with another one immunity from alcohol is intensive work with another alcoholic. You could put in drugs in there. This activity works when other activities fail. So it's telling us we have to be sponsors, we have to work with the other alcoholics. But in the 12 and 12, and this is where I see this going, I pray, on step 5, until we've spoken with complete candor to someone and they've done the same with us, we still didn't belong. Step 5 was the answer. It was the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. So what is it saying? Not only do I have to speak a 5th step, I have to hear a 5th step. Who hears a 5th step? Sponsor hears a 5th step. So until I've heard a 5th step,
I still don't belong. I'm just circling the field, waiting to run out of spiritual gasoline, and then it's another crash and burn. So now what do we do? So we have to go somewhere. We're going to have to get off our comfort zone. You know, Bill said pain was the touchstone of all spiritual growth, and I believe that you can't be comfortable and grow spiritually at the same time. It's not going to happen. So we're going to have to get out of our comfort zone and actually go somewhere and go to the halfway houses, the three-quarter houses, go to the rehabs and partner with them and help them make the transition between rehab and AA, between the halfway houses in AA, between the VA, between the missions in AA. You know, the field is ripe. It's an epidemic. It's, you know, the room, when I see a room that's half full, it's crazy. I mean, you know, we have the answer. We have the resource. We have the people available to make this thing at least manageable and start getting a leg up on it. But nobody seems to want to do anything. You know, it's just like, what's up with that? You know, and I really like what you're doing. I mean, Bill said, you know, we go to AA not to make it a life, but to get a life. But I missed that part.
Amen. Well, I've become an old man doing this. I started when I was 25 and I'm 63 now. So I have I've grown old doing it. And I got to tell you, one thing that just keeps bottom lining to me because is this. I believe it's a disease. I counseled for 20 years before we started seeing the MRIs. I had to run around going, we think it's a disease. It acts like a disease. We're going to use the disease concept. But the MRIs ended all of that. We know it's a disease. It breaks the neurotransmitter uptake system and regulation system. It does damage to the frontal lobes. We know how quick it happens. We know what makes it worse with who. We know what the genetic elements are, or a whole lot about all these things. We know what age issues are, and they're massive. The things that happen with a 15-year-old's brain when exposed to these substances is a totally different thing than what happens to a 28-year-old's brain. So we know lots and lots and lots of stuff. And because of that, because we kept plugging at it, you know what? We're getting more people sober now than we did in 1975 when I started. I say getting. We're helping them get sober. More people get sober. We're helping more. Well, if it's a disease, then obviously the object is always to get 10 out of 10 well. And until we get there, there's either something we're not doing that we should or doing something we shouldn't. And we probably won't know what it is until about 5 years we'll look back on it and go, oh, boy, that was stupid. It's kind of like using alternative peer groups with adolescents. Forever we went around going, well, you know, for young people it's very important who they hang out with. What are we talking about? Stick with Winners came out of an adult AA program. That was a slogan from adult AA. It's just as important for a 45-year-old to go hang out with people who can lead him to recovery as it is for a 14-year-old. And in fact, maybe more. But we made mistake forever and ever and ever. And we've stopped now. And you know what? Our adult APG is growing. It's the fastest growing thing we've got going. And it's able to do all sorts of things. 2 years ago, I had a liver transplant because this disease will kill you early on while you're getting high, or it'll just lay around for 36 years and kill you later.
You mean that?
And it almost killed me 2 years ago.
The chickens are coming home to roost. Is that what you're saying?
Uh-huh. Yeah. 36 years sober, and they're going, oh, you're going to die of drug abuse. But we're going to call it cancer of the liver that's been caused by the hepatitis C and hepatitis B.
That you got from drugs.
25.
Yeah.
It wasn't cancer killing me. It was drug abuse. That's what was killing me. And but again, grace. I mean, I had the transplant. It was incredible. We were doing this adult program through the transplant. I had a chance to create relationships with the liver and organ health people, Dr. Mansour and Dr. Galati at Methodist Hospital. And you know what we're doing now? We're working these alternative peer groups with adults. with some of their patients, because they got guys who can't even get sober enough to con them enough to get a transplant. It's like guys who can't stay sober enough to keep from, you know, their probation officer putting them in jail. It's the same thing. So they started using these adult alternative peer groups. Now they were going to AA, getting their sheet signed, going out and getting drunk and bringing the sheet back, and then wondering why they got busted on their alcohol level. You know, it wasn't enough. But with these APGs, we're adding an extra amount of support, and they're more able to use AA. We're more able to help them through those times when the window of sanity closes. But we found these ways to get them past that till it opens up again. And it's through those friendships and that family work. So that's what we're hoping for, is one day, you know, we just keep on playing. One day we get 10 out of 10. We figure out enough tricks. And
well, they used to have.
Things to say that we get there.
If you look back in the literature, it says, well, 50% got well right away. Yay. And the other 25% after a couple of relapses. So 75% is not an alien number to AA. It is today, but it wasn't when it started. So with Rum Radio, we're looking back at that and say, hey, what did they do? And one of the things, my experience is, when I sponsor someone, people come in the program, and I was the same way. We come in bankrupt of all, usually physically, emotionally, and spiritually. We come in bankrupt, right? So some people not physically, some people, but usually everybody's coming in spiritually bankrupt to some degree. So you start working with a sponsee, and all of a sudden you get them through the steps. They have hope. You can see the light in their eye. They come in with dark eyes. I've seen it. I've physically seen the manifestation of the darkness. The scriptures talk about it. If the eye is the windows of the soul,
in their eye. You bet.
And the eye is dark. How dark is that? How dark is that soul? And I've seen it. I've seen it come in with dark. They dark in the eyes. There's no light in the eye. And then they start working the steps. And then all of a sudden, usually on step five, the lights come on. Somebody flipped the light back on. The spirit has reintroduced himself. And I think it's a mistake to figure out that you cannot dismiss the spiritual aspect of this disease. So what I see, I hope for, is that making hearing a step five becomes a rite of passage. No chairing a meeting until you've heard a fifth step. No becoming a GSR or a DCM. These are structures in the thing. You can't really do much because you don't belong yet. So you're supposed to have heard a fifth step. So if enough people aren't coming in, then you're going to have to go out and go find someone so you can hear your fifth step. You can work with the newcomer and hear that fifth step. Then you'll see, I believe, AA, NA, and the sister groups starting to fill up again. When we go outside our comfort zone and start getting them, go get them. Okay, I'm off the soapbox.
Makes sense to me, man. Makes sense to me.
Now all we have to do, if what is it, the big book says, I'm the director of the play. Now if they'll only do it my way, everybody will be happy.
There
but,
you go.
You know, all I can, all I can do is present
people?
The idea. I'm giving them the answer. They want to know how come I'm telling them how to run their railroad. Hey,
what's
who do you think
deal?
You are? You think you're smarter than me? You know, you never talk down to an alcoholic. You want to get in trouble, you talk down to them. Even if they think you might be talking down to them, why, are you just a smart guy? Hey, Mr. Smart Guy. He comes from out of town. He's going to tell us how to work the program. Here we go. Good luck. So tell us, how do we get a hold of you, or people have problems, kids, you got phone numbers, website, how do we get a hold of you?
Well, my phone number is 713-270-6753, and we are in Houston, we are in Dallas, we are in Little Rock, we have a sister program in Santa Clarita, California, We're doing adults with liver issues and other organs in San Diego, working with Scripps Hospital there. And if we're not in your city, we know what other alternative peer groups there are. And the web has made it amazing where we can do all sorts of things from Skype. In fact, we have a program right outside of Sofia, Bulgaria, the first alternative peer group in Europe.
Wow.
Back home, they're working with it some. It's just one of those God things. Just walks, you know, walk the walk, and that's where it led. God always does weird stuff like that. You know, you're hanging out. It could have been Paris or London, but no, it's Bulgaria.
Bulgaria. Who would have thought?
We're there. But we're so at 713-270-6753. There is a website. It's Lifeway International. How's that? Is that cocky or what? LifewayInternational.org. All, you know, no spaces or anything. And, gosh, that's how you get in touch. It's real, real easy. Those two ways of doing it right there.
One of the drunks told me, it's only bragging if you can't do it.
I would like to say, some of the stuff that we were talking about as far as families, you know, and parents, and there's also a book that was written called Recovering Our Children. You can get it at Amazon.com. I was a co-author of that.
Co-author.
And, co-author. And so that's available, too, along with all the other great stuff there is. But anything we can do to help, let me know. we also have a private high school, Three Oaks Academy, and you can dig into more of that, threeoaksacademy.org. There are only 24 recovery schools in the United States. Two of them are here in Houston, Texas. There has been a very, very unusual thing happen with adolescent and young adult recovery in these alternative peer groups, and the guy who was the producer of The Anonymous People, a documentary that just got a lot of play recently, is now doing, while he was shooting that all over the country, kept hearing about this adolescent young adult recovery in Houston, this alternative peer group, something that has happened here over the last 43 years that hasn't happened anywhere else. We have this huge young people say, hey, it doesn't exist in other places. But these alternative peer groups have pumped young people into recovery and gotten them started for the last 43 years. So now we have this huge young people in, you know, community, in recovery community. Well, sure enough, he came here to inspect it, found it was true, and they're now doing a documentary on this 43-year phenomena that's happened here that hasn't happened anywhere else in the world. These two recovering schools that are here, one being Three Oaks Academy, they are the only recovery schools in the world that all the students are part of alternative peer groups. And it changes things a lot. Therefore, Vanderbilt University is here doing a study on that, along with the University of Wisconsin and some other things. Houston is an exciting place for recovery. If we're looking for one more out of 10, Houston is finding that. They're just now in some of the other parts of the country going, oh, well, maybe we could do peer recovery and those kind of things. We've been doing it here for 43 years, you know, and they're really starting to take a look.
That's
so there
great.
You have it. That's how you get in touch.
I had a sponsee. He was Dan, and he was a ship's captain, an oil tanker like Joe Hazelton and the Valdez. Remember that?
Uh-huh.
Like that. That's what he did. And, I had a sponsee. And he was a chronic relapser from New Jersey. And what they did in his home group, not of all of New Jersey, was that you had to go to meetings for a year before you could work the steps. And then you worked the steps at step studies and not with a sponsor. That's how they did business up there. And I go, what? you had to go to meetings for... I said, what?
There's all sorts of things out there.
I'm telling you, yeah, in some places in Canada they do that too. That's how the year has gone. And he's brought up Rum Radio and some of this information, and they're just like, you know, they're astounded. Where did this stuff come from? And he always just say, you know, Joseph, you're at the point of the sword. Oh, that's very romantic. Oh, thank you. I'm an alcoholic. So, hey, that sounds great to me. Anything grandiose. You got
That's
something
right.
grandiose? Sign me up. Sign
That's
me up right,
right
there. There you
That's
go.
Right.
That's
right. There you go. I like that.
There's nothing so common as the wish to be remarkable.
That's right.
Harold, you got any last words?
Well, I've enjoyed listening, and I'm really happy to hear that such great results are being achieved, and that's new information for me. I work with a lot of kids and families and their families in family therapy at the Houston Center for Christian Counseling. And so we have a lot of certified drug counselors there and family therapists and LPCs, as well as folks who do EMDR for post-traumatic stress disorder and other traumas. So I think there will be a way for us to work together and refer.
Sure. Say hi to Tim Mabergeorge for me, would you?
Yes, absolutely. He's a great boss. I've never
he
worked
is,
with such
he is.
People. Yes. So thanks for being on. This has been a great program tonight.
Well, thank you guys. Like I said, it was just a pleasure and an honor. Just you guys are great. Y'all keep up the good work. Anything I can ever do, you just let me know.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you, John. Thanks for being there for us and for the work you do. You know, they say that it really is one drunk working with another. I did a post on the man on the bed. It's the iconic picture of the beginning of AA. And the three people that were on in that picture, we had Dr. Bob, Bill W., who was the chief architect of AA, and Bill D., who was a lawyer. So to start
right.
this thing of ours, we had a doctor, a lawyer, and an Indian chief.
There you go.
and if you look at the picture, the fellow in the foreground, I believe, was Dr. Bob. He has a book in his hand 4 years prior to the publication of the big book. And Bill D. was number three. He brought to the program. So that only proves that one drunk talking to another is still, to this very day, our most powerful tool of persuasion.
Amen.
So thanks again, John. Thanks, Harold, for
jumping
in.
You're welcome.
In closing, I'd like to say Rum Radio and rumradio.org. We're in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,800 towns, cities, and villages. And we're very popular in Nepal. You know why we're popular in Nepal?
Why?
They like our yak. So if you're looking for sponsorship information, good, solid recovery sponsorship information, some good posts, traditions, we stayed to basic lines of the program because we found that's all we need. So that correct information, I try to make it humorous, and it's spiritual. So remember, if you're looking for something, it's on rumradio.org. And remember, and we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org.
All right.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.